Well, hello and welcome to the After the Sermon podcast. This is a Bethany Church podcast where every week we get to dive in deeper into the sermon so that you guys can hopefully get more and more out of it, because we only have 40, 45 minutes, or if that's preaching, 50 minutes.
Only a couple times I've been here.
But there's just so much more that we can get out of it. So it's fun to be able to do this every week. And I'm Joe, and I'm joined by Tammy DeLau.
Thrilled to be here.
Yeah, and Pastor Thad, you are here, and we're starting a new series this week. It's a five-week series, so through Nehemiah, and we're actually talking about Esther today. So.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's going to be fun today because we are starting a new series, but again, we're going to try to get into maybe some things that we can't cover as much in the sermon, but we'll see. So we're starting Nehemiah. It's called Nehemiah, Rise, Rebuild, and Restore, and we're going to see certain things within Nehemiah, how you see the people rise up, how you see the walls rebuilt, and there's other things that we can see in there, and how certain faith practices are restored within the book of Nehemiah, and how that applies to our situation right now today. Mm-hmm. And so it's pretty amazing. And then also kind of as a bonus there, we're going to talk about remembering God at the very end of the series, because the people of God, people of faith throughout history have always seemed to ebb and flow. Yeah. You know, it'll be good, we'll forget God, we won't remember him, it'll go bad, and then there's this restoration, and then again, you rise, rebuild, restore. You have all of this. But one of the dynamics, so when we got into our exile series in the book of Daniel, we started in Jeremiah to launch us into Daniel. And so as I was studying this series, I just was looking at all the timelines and the history, and I said, man, I think we need to start in Esther to launch us into the book of Nehemiah, because there's some really important things that we need to see there. And so with Esther, I think we see that there needs to be, at certain times, risk, because without risk, there is no faith in God. And you see that in the book of Esther. And so, I want to talk about Esther, and if there was a subtitle, it's risk in such a time as this, right? Coming from one of the famous statements within.
Yeah.
Oh, there is so. Think about this. Think about this with Nehemiah. If you add risk into it with Esther, it's risk, rise, rebuild, restore, remember. So Baptist. Yeah. But I love it so much. So much. So we'll be knocking that out.
Those things really do help us remember, though. So it's good.
It is kind of funny. It really does. It really does help. Mm-hmm. And especially before the days of technology, where it was really easy to have a bunch of different movement and things to help trigger a memory. Starting those R's, sadly, showing my age a little bit, I can remember when that was, you know, still being taught in seminary as a device to help people's memory. So pretty fun there. So, all right. So just for us hanging out here, because some of this stuff I can't get into, or I'll get into some. But Cyrus the Great, right, conquered Babylon, the date of his reign, roughly. And keep in mind, guys, as you study this for your small groups, grow groups, and everything you're doing, you're going to run into different dates. Some will slide just 10 to 15, 20 years. Some will be larger slides as you get into certain things within these texts, even the dating of Esther and when this account happened. And so just keep in mind, when I'm speaking of what is predominantly the traditional view. And so if you find something different, I'm not saying that it's wrong. It's just, you know, you can kind of match those up and use your best judgment there. So Cyrus was so important, knew the prophet Daniel, began, allowed the people, the Jewish people, to start to go back home. So very, very powerful ruler there in a great moment, because the people have been exiled, they've been defeated, and this is the beginning, the first of three waves of them coming back to Jerusalem. Not going to talk too much about Darius right now, but then you have Xerxes, who is Esther's husband, who we're going to talk about here in just a moment. And then you have Artaxerxes, who is Queen Esther's stepson, and Nehemiah was his cupbearer once we really jump in to Nehemiah. And so you see three or four kings there that are very important in this rebuilding phase for the Jewish people in Jerusalem. So pretty interesting there. Also, if you look on the timeline I've given you guys, and these guys don't have it, although I will have this timeline up on slides for the sermon, you can have so much fun with this because you've gotten 538, 539 BC, the return of the first exiles to Judah, 516, the temple being rebuilt, 583 through 573, again, approximate date, Esther, queen of Persia, 458, the second return led by the priest Ezra, 444, the third return led by Nehemiah. So pretty fascinating stuff here with the timeline. But then even historically with the chart that you guys are looking at, which I'll have this available, you can see the clash that's starting to happen between Persian and Grecian forces, because it's not so long after this, about 100 years after Nehemiah comes back and restores this, that you begin to get into the 400 years of silence from God before Messiah is here. And keep in mind, this is the grand sweep of biblical history and world history, and they flow together in parallel, and you can just see God manipulating all of this. And so we're about to go into 40 years of silence, but in 333, you've got the Battle of Issus, and Alexander the Great defeats the Persians. And what begins is really the Grecian Empire in the Hellenistic period. Greek translation of the Old Testament, widely distributed. And you also have things eventually where the Romans come in BC 63 or 63 BC. Roads are being built. Everything is happening, preparing the way for Jesus. Mm-hmm. And it's just so powerful to see this stuff happen. Again, I will...
That's amazing.
I'll show this again, but it's just really important there too, during that Hellenistic period, and the fact that the Old Testament was copied over in Greek, and that just gave such wider access to the scriptures. And then, of course, and the revolt of the Maccabees was powerful in Jewish histories, but when the Roman Empire came in there and conquered Judah, again, you have those roads being built, you have that Roma Pax Ulna, the peace, and you've already got the Greek transcripts of the Old Testament so that people can read them widely.
That's interesting.
Which sets the stage for, boom, the answer of Messiah in history, and the ready access to the Old Testament. And then the New Testament, if you flip it over into the 40s, 50s, 60s, you have the New Testament.
That's amazing. So in 250, that Greek translation of the Old Testament, so whenever I've read the Bible and I'm Paul and stuff like that, I've always thought they didn't have the Old Testament because that was just a Jewish thing, like only written in Hebrew. I never knew it was translated into Greek. So would people have already had a bit of a foundation under them when Paul came into their...
Called the Septuagint. Matter of fact, I did a paper years ago, and it talked about a lot of the different kind of understandings that people had regarding what they read in the Septuagint of the Old Testament, even about Adam and Eve and the different beliefs that were surfacing there. Because you had liberal scholarship that has come in at different points and said, oh, you can't trust the Old Testament, or you can't do this, or whatever. But you can look as early as 250 B.C., with that copy and how that became more available through time, how absolutely they had access to it and teaching, and then temple and eventually synagogues and all these kinds of things. So it's a powerful thing, because even your God-fearers, right?
Yeah.
Who read, like the people read in Greek, that's when it was translated.
That's amazing. It's almost like it's been set up since the beginning of time. God knew at 250, I'm going to translate this into Greek, and then Jesus is going to come. The Jews are going to reject him, and then the gospel is going to go to the Greeks.
It's almost like we serve a sovereign God.
Yeah. It's almost like it.
Yeah. So you have that 400 years of silence, but it's really not silence.
It's
preparatory. Yeah. And think about that Greek translation and people having more and more access and the time that was given. So it was translated copy, but the time that was given for that to be disseminated through the populations and
That's
for people
fun.
To have access to it, and so all of that. So it really, wow! Because again, it's antiquity, it's ancient times. So if we see something translated, it can be put online, everybody can have it within a couple of weeks or whatever. So it does take a little while, but God knew that. And again, look, with the timing, it wasn't written in Persian, so to speak. It was. God waited and used Alexander the Great under the Greek Empire, that Hellenistic period, to bring it to a place, to, even through the Roman Empire, that until Latin came about, for people to be able to read in that common language. Wow. So
that's fun to dive into a little bit.
It, isn't it? So all of our nerd hats are coming out.
Yeah, I like this a little too much.
Yeah, I've got another chart for you here, but this is just simply something you have fun with. And the first chart I gave you, you can also look at it too, where it talks a little bit about the prophets and where they were in the midst of all of this time. And so, yeah. Really just good stuff. And I wanted to share a little bit about the history, and we're going to share some of that also in the sermon.
So quick question for you. Sorry.
Hopefully I can answer it.
Is Nehemiah like the last Old Testament book that was written before Jesus?
He was the last chronological historical having to do with the city itself.
Gotcha.
So you're really sweeping into that last, because you're going to have some disagreements, but you could say it's either one of the last or last.
Yep.
Recorded, I guess you could say it that way.
That makes sense.
So, awesome. So, this brings us to Esther. So, if you look at your timeline on there, Esther, 483, the story of Queen Esther, somewhere starting right around in there, and that's where we're going to kind of pick up our story and talk about what's going on in Esther. So, in Esther chapter 1, right? Are we good to start? Right?
Yeah,
we're
going
to jump in. Okay.
I'm
all right.
So excited.
The prime is the pump is primed.
Esther.
All right. So here we go. We're getting into Esther, and you mentioned sovereignty, man.
Mm-hmm.
What a story of God's sovereignty, because God is actually nowhere mentioned in this, but there's multiple places where you can see almost like a reference to God. Mm-hmm. For example, even in the name of Jew, and how Mordecai said, don't tell me you're Jew yet, or whatever, that kind of thing. And then tell me you're a Jew and all this kind of stuff, because a Jew has an automatic association with worshiping the one God. Then also when Esther says, fast for me, and get people together to do that too.
Mm-hmm.
Fasting is always associated with prayer. You wouldn't just, it sounds silly if I say, hey, I want you just to not eat for me.
Yeah, please don't eat.
Yeah, just don't eat for me. No.
Who would do that?
It was, fast and pray and all of that. And so, and again, we're going to see that God's fingerprints are all over this. But even though his name isn't mentioned, which in one way is so good for us too, right? Because there's times in our life when we don't feel the hand of God, but yet we can look back and see that it was there.
Yeah.
So anyways, all of that is good. So we come to chapter 1, and I call this on my outline here, the Great Persian Party, right? kings and their parties. So Xerxes is here, and he's having this huge party, and he's inviting everyone in, his leaders, all of this kind of stuff. Everybody's drinking, having a great time. And what most commentators believe is happening here, he's preparing for his early wars with Greece. And so what he does is he brings everyone to his Susa, his capital there, which, remember, Susa from Daniel is a great winter residence for the kings of this area. So he's bringing them into Susa, like many kings in the past. We talked about it with Daniel. Throws a great party, and the idea is, hey, be confident. We can beat these Greece guys. We can plan this out. Look at all my wealth. Look at all my people. Look at all my money. And even talks about often the king would say, hey, here's the cutoff on what kind of alcohol we're going to serve and how much. He's like, no limits. So it is quite the party, and quite a lengthy party as well. So anyways, he's preparing for Greece. He actually, in 481 BC, has a great victory over Grecian forces at Thermopylae, but then turns around at Salamis and loses in 480 BC, and so he ends up coming back. But during this planning party that they're having here in chapter 1, he summons Queen Vashti. And now this is interesting here, and you can find this particular part of the story in verses 10 through 20. So him and his boys are drunk, right? Mm-hmm. Three sheets to the wind, all that kind of stuff. And he summons the queen. Now, when you read this, you're thinking, dude, what's up with Vashti? Why doesn't she want to come?
Yeah. Why is she disobeying her husband?
Yeah. What's up with that? Oh, funny stuff. It is so good. I literally laughed out loud when I read some of the stuff in here in chapter 1. But if you read it, you're thinking, maybe, the guys are drunk or whatever. But it could be. It could be, because it's, come on out with a crown and all that kind of stuff. It could be that he was saying, I want you to come on out with wearing nothing but the crown in front of a bunch of drunk men. And so when you start to think about it, well, if it was that, all this, not only, maybe you could see, man, the king is drunk. You're asking your woman, your queen, your wife, to come out with all these drunk, you know, rambunctious men. Mm-hmm. Not a good idea to start with. No. But then, if that was the case, right, trying to brag and look at my beautiful wife or whatever, you know, it really smacks us as just completely wrong. Mm-hmm. But it was a rough area. But even within then, I could see the queen saying, I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to show myself like that. I'm not going to disgrace myself like this. You're drunk. And I wonder if she was thinking to herself, the king will get sober, because, you know, you're not supposed to disobey the king. The king will get sober. He's going to think differently.
She may have thought she was protecting him.
Yeah.
At some level.
Absolutely. And he'll forgive me for disobeying him because of this. But then, man, I hope we're doing good with time, because I just got to throw this out there. Listen mm-hmm. at this. You want to talk about some crazy talk. Okay, so this is chapter 1, verse 16. And then the presence of the king and the official, and the king is asking them, what should we do? And this is what the guys are saying, not only has Queen Vashti done wrong to the king, but also to all the officials and all the peoples who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes. For this deed of the queen will be made known to all women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media, who have heard the queen's behavior, will rebel against the king's officials, and there will be no end of contempt and wrath. And basically saying, King, you can't let this stand, because if you let your wife disobey you, then our wives are going to think they can disobey us.
Yeah.
I mean, just hilarious. And so literally he writes this decree in verse 20. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all of his kingdom, vast as it was, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. Verse 21, this advice pleased the king and the officials, and the king did as this gentleman proposed, sent letters everywhere declaring that every man should be master in his own house.
Power trip.
What? It's... This is why I love the Bible, because it puts crazy stuff in there.
Yeah,
you know, like,
it's true.
Why would you necessarily even need that in that? But anyways, it just shows you where the state of affairs were in all things at the time.
Mm-hmm. And
it
the also, hearts of man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it heightens what Esther's going to do lately, because essentially Vashti is banished from the king for mm-hmm. her disobedience. Yeah. So it just heightens what Esther's about to do. But I remember reading that and I literally laughed out loud. It's like, that's almost like the...
because it's so ludicrous.
Yeah, it's ludicrous. It's mm-hmm. like a butt of a... It's like a joke, mm-hmm. but it's real, mm-hmm. you know? And so it happens. Love the Bible and its authenticity there, so...
That's the beautiful thing about the Bible, is it does show the good and the bad. Most mm-hmm. history books are written to show the good.
Yeah.
And so, mm-hmm. gotta love that about our God, that he lets us see it all.
So in chapter 2, we are introduced to Mordecai and Esther and their background. Verses 5 and 7, I'll just read it quickly. Now there was a Jew in the citadel of Susa whose name was Mordecai. He was a Benjamite. His ancestors had been carried off from during Nebuchadnezzar to Babylon. Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his cousin, for she had neither father nor mother. You know, in other words, you know, lost her parents somehow. Mm-hmm. The girl was fair and beautiful when her father and her mother died, and Mordecai adopted her as his own daughter. So they were cousins, but he adopted her as daughter. So he's probably older than her pretty significantly, but really took her under his wing. And so here you have this beautiful young woman adopted by Mordecai, great guy, trying to help her out. You'll also see in verses 21 and 23 that Mordecai stumbles across a plot and ends up saving the king. So pretty interesting dynamic there. But in the first four verses, you end up having, I believe it's here in chapter 2, the first appearance of the bachelor, right? In the worst way possible, right? Because he comes back, being defeated by Greece, most likely, and he begins to miss the queen. Mm-hmm. And so his advisors, rather than trying to figure out a way to get the queen back, says, hey, we need to get him a beautiful young virgin. We need to mm-hmm. have this contest. And that's exactly what he does. And Esther gets picked within this contest. Mordecai warns her, don't say that you're a Jew, at least not at the time. And Esther gets mm-hmm. selected to eventually become the new king. So things are good. How are we doing on time, Joe? 17? So I'm going to speed up a little bit here. So things are looking pretty good. Mordecai saves the king. However, he's not rewarded right away, but the plot is discovered to kill the king. Again, commentators think that some people may be upset with how he fought against the Grecian Empire and just not liking what's happening there, and so they're trying to get rid of him. But they fail because Mordecai saves him. Important for later on. Then there's this plot to destroy the Jews. We learn about Haman, the Agagite, and his issues with Mordecai. If we had time, we could look into it, that Haman is a descendant of King Agag from the Amalekites, and how they were enemies going all the way back to the time of Saul, and how this not bowing to Haman has multiple implications both ways about why they really dislike each other. So anyways, he hatches this plot, Haman does. He's been raised up to the second command underneath the king. He hatches this plot to kill the Jews, destroy the Jews. And so we come down to this hinge moment in chapter 4, and this is when Mordecai says, "Hey, Esther, you've got to stop this. Mm-hmm. We're all about to lose our life." Yep. And you really get just this concept here in verse 11 where Esther finds out what Mordecai wants her to do. She's like, "Hey, man, I remember what happened to Vashti. You want me to approach the king without being summoned? I haven't been summoned in 30 days. If I walk in there and I'm not called, I die." Mm-hmm. And the last queen who just didn't show up when she was called, she was banished forever. What do you want me to do? And by the way, Esther's rise up through the harem was unusual. Normally, Persian kings would marry nobility somewhere, right? Like most kings do. This is not a normal situation, right? This is a little bit abnormal.
So she's not a normal queen.
Yeah, not a normal queen for sure. And so anyways, but we just have to read. We have to stop here for Mordecai's famous response to her and then Esther's courage. So it's verses 12 through 17 in chapter 4. Let me find it here. So when they told Mordecai what Esther had said, because like she's freaking out, you know, this, if I go before the king, I'm going to die if I'm not summoned. And Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter." Wow, what a statement. What faith. Talk about God's not mentioned in here. I don't know, man. That's a lot of faith.
Mordecai has a lot of faith.
Yeah, yeah. "But you and your father's family will perish, that is, if you're not helping. So who knows? Perhaps you've come to royal dignity for just such a time as this." In other words, take this risk for such a time as this. This is the time to be faithful. "Then Esther said in reply to Mordecai, 'Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf.'" In other words, fast and pray. "And neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. And I and my maids will also fast as you do. And after that, I'll go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." Wow. I mean, that's the heart of the book right there. That's the statement of the book, that the queen here is willing to risk it all to save the people. And when she's saving her people, we know on this side of history, she's not just saving her people. She's saving the people from which the Messiah will come, for which we are all grateful for salvation. But this is an absolutely monstrous statement. She's literally going to be walking in there thinking, "This is it. I'm going to die." And so she does.
Yeah.
Esther in chapter 5 goes before the king. He extends to her the scepter, which means she's welcomed. And so begins her march to asking the queen to, or asking the king to not do this thing. For time's sake, man, there's so many beautiful things that happen here. The king won not, so Haman wants to kill all of the Jews. Esther goes in. She's asking the king to come to banquets with Haman over time so that she can point out what Haman's doing, talking about that she's a Jew as well, all of these type of things. There's even this weird scene where he's begging for his life to the queen because he knows this isn't going good. He must have tripped or fall or something. He falls on her. King walks back in the room, and it looks like he's trying to attack her. So anyways, he gets hung on the very gallows, so to speak, that he was supposed to, or he wanted to hang Mordecai on, and he bites the dust. But I wanted to talk about one more situation here with Esther, and it's one that we don't hear very much about. So we know Esther risked her life to have all of, you know, to save the Jews, all, you know, to save Mordecai. But there's a dynamic where once the king, and we saw this in Daniel, the Medo-Persians, once a king says here's the edict. It can't be undone because many people thought they were gods. But what you could do, you couldn't undo that, but what you could do is you could create a new edict that essentially would counterbalance or erase that one. Mm-hmm. Although you didn't erase it, it's just they give kind of the opposite. But still, at this point, you know, she's done this, Haman's hung, all of this, but the edict is still out there, and it's already been sent out to all these provinces, mm-hmm. and the Jews are going to come under attack. So she has to go back to the king and ask for the ability to have this essentially undone. And so in chapter 8, verses 3 through 6, then Esther spoke again to the king. She fell at his feet, weeping and pleading with him to avert the evil design of Haman the Agagite and the plot that he devised against the Jews. Now, keep in mind, she had to approach him. He had to extend the scepter again. So she's going again to the king, right? The king held out the golden scepter to Esther, and Esther rose and stood before the king. And she said, if it pleases the king, and if I've won his favor, and if the thing seems right before the king, and I have his approval, let an order be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agite, which he wrote, giving orders to destroy the Jews who are in all the provinces of the king. For how can I bear to see the calamity that is coming on my people, or how can I bear to see the destruction of my kindred? And so Mordecai, who in the story has been elevated to Haman's position, his wisdom is then used. He writes letters saying that the Jews can defend themselves. They have victory over all of their enemies in Purim, I think is how you pronounce it, is now celebrated for Esther and Mordecai's victory in saving their people. So with the time we have remaining, We've walked through 10 chapters like in a blur, right? In an absolute blur. So many great things that we see here. One of those is God's sovereignty. Mm-hmm. The appointment of Esther and how unusual that is, right?
Big time.
Mordecai overhearing this plot, right? He just happens to overhear a plot to assassinate the king, and he saves him. But he doesn't get rewarded right away. He gets rewarded later, and it's interesting in the story how Haman has to go behind him calling everything. It's just great, but he gets that position of honor. How God had the gallows or had the pole, or maybe even it was a crucifix, because the Persians really truly invented or brought crucifixion to bear. So it could have also been that. Isn't this fascinating? So when Mordecai saved the king, what he did was written in the books. One night, the king can't sleep. This is how he finds out about Mordecai. His servants bring in the book and reads to him about Mordecai. And he's like, what do we do to reward this man? And the book say we didn't do anything. And so he's like, all right, well, let's reward him, right? Yeah. And so he gets rewarded. But again, brings him at just the right time to be able to intervene and eventually write these letters that essentially overturns his earlier edict.
Amazing.
All of these things work perfectly. Couple things that this shows us. God can use anyone, no matter your history or your capability, has more to do with your availability to him and your willingness to risk it all for God. If you look at Mordecai, you see this generally good guy with wisdom, stand-up guy. You know, he's a guy that you could look and see these fellas in church or whatever, you know, or girl, right? Mm-hmm. But just a generally good, got a good testimony, right? If he was to give his testimony in church, he'd be like, you know, amen,
amen,
all that kind of stuff. But then also poor Esther is so good for us to see. Checkered past, essentially during her time in the harem, a sex slave, you know, brought before the king, no rights, nothing. But yet God used her to save a people and even the lineage of Messiah. And when we think about it in the church life, you know, we think about the Mordecai, but oh my goodness, if you're an Esther out there who maybe your past isn't as pretty, oh, how God can use you. Maybe you were objectified. Maybe you were whatever it was. These very difficult past, man, look at what God did through Esther, what courage, what bravery, all of these things. Man, Tammy, were you wanting to say something?
Oh, I have so many thoughts. I love the book of Esther. I think it's just a great book. And like you said, that we don't really see God's name in it, but we see God's hand all over it. And so that's encouraging for us. Yeah, I do think we do need to know that if our pasts aren't pretty, that God can still use that. And so that is very encouraging in this story with Esther. And I think just a thought that I was having is Esther behaved like a queen. Mm. She behaved like who she was. So often we wear what our past may be, and we don't behave that we are a child of the living God. So I don't know. I think there's just so many fun nuggets that we can pull out of this one.
And people talk about chapter 4 all the time. Mm-hmm. But chapter 8 is amazing too, mm-hmm. where she goes back again to make sure that the evil mm-hmm. that was done is essentially mm-hmm. undone. This is so powerful that mm-hmm. that I see in her. And again, going back to what we said earlier on, if God calls you, he calls you to risk, because without risk, there is no faith. Mm-hmm. This is one of those great, just as awesome as Moses going before Pharaoh, Daniel, mm-hmm. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego going before their kings. This is every bit as powerful as that moment in biblical history of her standing before the king like mm-hmm. that. When we talk about this rising up, rebuilding, restoring, rising, rebuilding, restoring, mm-hmm. all of these things with God, it starts in someone willing to risk. Mm-hmm. You know, even the first movement back to truth, that's a huge risk.
Yeah,
going back there and do this. And so God needs people willing to take risk. And I just wonder, and we're going to, this will be a highlight, this will be a part of the sermon, is where is God asking you to risk? You know, mm-hmm. what's he asking you to do? Because, you know, we're coming out of this COVID thing slowly. Mm-hmm. But in the future, there's going to be moments where God is asking you to risk something. I don't know what it is. But in that risk, have faith, because God is doing something special in restoration and rebuilding mm-hmm. And reviving all of these things that we need to yeah. see in the future. And so be on the watch. Where is God asking mm-hmm. you to risk, to maybe stand up for your faith, or to, I don't know what it is.
And who is your Mordecai? Yeah. Would Esther have been mm-hmm. willing to take the risk if mm-hmm. Mordecai didn't challenge her, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, good stuff.
Having advice for friends? Mm-hmm.
I didn't know we were going to be in Esther, so I was like Nehemiah yeah. prepared, but I'm thrilled.
Well, okay, so here's your Nehemiah connection. You guys did so good holding this in, okay? Right at the very end. So one of the reasons why I wanted Esther to launch into, and we're going to talk about Ezra when it comes to the chapter in Nehemiah where he's so prevalent. Mm-hmm. So in Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 6, Nehemiah's getting ready to ask the king of his favor to go back and mm-hmm. Restore the walls. And it says this in Nehemiah 2, 6, and the king said to me, in parentheses, the queen also was sitting beside him, how long will you be gone, and when you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I sent him a date. It's so unusual the way that statement's put together. It said, the king said to me, and then the queen was also sitting beside him. Why would he say that? What's also interesting about this particular word here is it normally speaks of maybe a lady over in charge of other ladies, or a lady in charge of a harem, so to speak. So it's just unusual. Now, the king is so friendly to Nehemiah and so generous to send him back. Mm-hmm. And yes, there's issues with Egypt, right? Different things going on, and it could be a buffer, right, for political, military reasons. But it also could be that Esther had influence on her stepson in this, or possibly could this have been Esther? Mm-hmm. It says the queen beside me. So think of the terminology used. Like, for example, we would call, say, President Clinton or President Bush, we still call them president, although they're not currently sitting mm-hmm. as president. It's a sign of respect. So he says the queen is sitting beside him. But then it's also the word for this ruler of lady over ladies or over a harem. You know, mm-hmm. this it's recognized as the queen. Well, normally these Persians would marry other Persian families of nobility, right? Or to increase their holdings, their status. Esther came up through the harem. Could it be that Esther was also there to try to protect those women as best she could, knowing what she went through? Mm-hmm. And here she is again, spending the course of her life, risking it all the time, and being there, being in her stepson's ear, hey, do this for my people. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. which said, you know what, launched me. Whether it's actually her or, you know, maybe her influence or something like that, which I just, boy, it's so tantalizing to think that it's her.
Yeah, why would you mention it?
Yeah, why would you mention it? Why would you bring that up? Knowing the generosity, could the legendary Esther be sitting there? And he says this just as a nod or a wink that the queen was there.
You know who she is.
Yes, you know who she is. Mm-hmm. And she's helping me. She's still risking it all for a time such as this and the rebuilding of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So there you go. That's why.
So it wasn't just one time she was risking it.
Oh, no. At least, yeah. At least we see here, you know, you see it there early in the book of Esther, you see it later in the book of Esther, and you could potentially see it now in Nehemiah. Mm-hmm. She fully gave her life as a queen would to save her people, to live with integrity, to live with a righteousness, and to bring glory to God and to save God's people. Yeah. And man, she's inspiring. And if that is the queen in that moment, man, why wouldn't we segue into Nehemiah with her leadership and her risking it all in faith? So, because that gives Nehemiah then to have faith and to ask for these things. Remember, because he prayed up, arrow-prayered into the ask, and perhaps she was there giving him courage.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think so many times, like us as Christians, we look for that Esther moment where it's like, okay, this is my time, and I'll make the right decision when that time comes. But I feel like the Lord gives us small things to risk in the meantime so that we can be faithful with a little. He'll put us in charge of more things to come. So I like your question at the end there. What's God asking us to risk?
To risk.
What's God asking us?
Well, and I just love how you are showing us that God's word is interconnected and that each book is wonderful in and of it by itself, but we do miss a dimension. I wanted you to go back to the northern and southern kingdom and just show the divide and why they were in exile, but I know there's so much, but it's just a beautiful thing to see God's sovereignty from the garden.
Even back with our Daniel series, you know, there's the different of when exactly did Daniel get there and how old was he when this happened and all of that. And so, you know, and I'm okay with not knowing all of the details, and it's super fun for me to think about all the variables. But the bottom line is you see the sovereign hand of God in history moving these people to bring about Messiah, to bring about salvation.
I mean, that's undeniable for sure.
Yeah, I think it's... Hegeschichte is the German root word for salvation history. And it's been so coined that because it's so powerful, because as theologians have sat down throughout the years, and many of the German ones, they have realized that God's history, his salvation history, is certain. You can't thwart it.
No.
So.
Yep. I know.
Yeah, I'm going to throw my quote that I shared with you guys in before we end, because I just think it's such a good one. This is from Dick Lucas, and he says, "The Bible is for us, but not always immediately about us." I think that's hard for us as Americans. We don't always enjoy the history lesson because we just want it to be, what is the nugget? What can I take away? How does that affect my tomorrow? And it's good. It's good for us to see who this was written for, what they would have heard if they would have known. That's Esther they're referring to, and we're like, the queen. Yeah, I mean, you know, like, so.
You know, in a real sense, even beyond us being Americans, this is our people.
Absolutely.
And we can take pride in our faith family. In a positive way, in a good way.
In a good way.
Very much. Well, thank you for joining us today, and we pray that you will have a wonderful week, and we'll see you Sunday.
Risk something.
Amen.